This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Being a family caregiver, taking care of a loved one who is ill, elderly, or disabled, is hard. But it's harder than it needs to be, and there are things that we can do to change that, according to my guest, Suzanne Geffen-Mintz. She speaks both as a caregiver and as the co-founder and president of the National Family Caregivers Association, which provides information, support, and advocacy. Mintz is the author of the book, A Family Caregiver Speaks Up. Her husband has had MS since 1974. He now needs help with the daily activities of living, dressing, bathing, toileting, eating, mobility, and transferring from bed to wheelchair. Mintz's book describes many of the emotions and day-to-day issues that affect caregiving families. Suzanne Mintz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get to a scary moment in your life that you bring up in your book. And like one of the scary moments is when your loved one is getting released from the hospital in a very compromised situation, maybe right after surgery or right after a stroke, and suddenly they're going to be in your care and you're not prepared for it and you don't know how to do it. So you tell the story in your book. This happened to you. Your husband, who has MS, on top of that, had bladder surgery. So he's getting released from the hospital with this big incision, and you live alone with him. You're 5 feet tall. What are some of the problems you had to deal with as soon as he was released back home?
Well, I think the problem started in the hospital where they wouldn't agree to give us a home care aide, because I knew that coming back home, Stephen was going to be in worse shape than he was when he went in. And I don't think we fully comprehended how much more difficult it would be. But it was very obvious as soon as we got home and we were trying to transfer him from the chair that we used for transportation to a manual chair in the house. And he, because of this incision across his stomach, he just was not able to use whatever strength he still had to help propel himself up. And so I went running around the neighborhood. We'd heard a lawnmower going in the yard behind us, and I just went running around the corner to see who I could find. And luckily, there was this tall, young, strapping guy. And I said, "I need your help. Come with me." And he, you know, was able to help. But it's silly to be put into a situation like that, which can certainly be extremely dangerous.
So what do you think should have been done? What kind of help should you have had when your husband was discharged?
Discharge planning is a misnomer, I would say. I would say it's not planning, it's just discharge. And there needs to be a more comprehensive way of helping families make that transition from hospital to home or hospital to nursing home. And we advise people to look into the discharge process as soon as they enter the hospital. I think part of the problem comes from the fact that people in hospitals, general hospitals, don't really understand disability. They don't seem to comprehend that if somebody's body does not work because of a spinal cord injury or whatever, that once you do a medical procedure, that they are going to be in worse shape than when they entered the hospital and therefore will need some extra assistance for a while going home. We reached out to a neighbor who was quite wonderful and came over during that first week, every evening around 10:30 and every morning around, 6:30, to help me get Stephen in and out of bed because I just couldn't do it by myself.
You mentioned that family caregivers aren't trained. And let's talk about a great and terrifying example of that. Often nowadays, when your loved one is sent home from the hospital, they have to continue to be on IV, and you are expected to administer it. And so what happens is someone from the hospital, well, not someone from the hospital, someone who the hospital has called, comes to your home, gives you the home IV equipment and the bags of medicine, gives you a very brief demonstration of how to do it, and suddenly you're giving IV to your spouse or friend or parent or whatever, and it can just be terrifying because you've read in the instruction manual that if there's like an air bubble in the IV that you can kill the person, and you're thinking like, I don't know how to do this. I'm not a nurse. I'm not a doctor. Can you talk about this a little bit and why we're in this position?
The system, if you will, obviously is constantly trying to save money. Well, one way to do that is to have people come home sooner, and because of advances in science, they can come home sooner. But as I mentioned before, they're not healing any sooner. It's just that they're doing it on our watch. And I personally think it is unsafe and irresponsible to put that responsibility on us without giving us the support. We need a buddy. We need a navigator, a person who aids us through this entire process. There is so much money lost and so many errors because of the lack of really good care coordination. There are constant transitions along the way, and there is not one person other than us who has that connection.
What are some of the most challenging things you've had to learn how to do medically as a caregiver for your husband who has MS?
Probably the most challenging thing is how to catheterize him. Stephen has a urogenic bladder, which basically means that the muscles of his bladder will not open automatically. It's the opposite side of people who can't control their urine. And so we have to catheterize him 4 or 5 times a day. And we, of course, were petrified. We were hoping it might be something Stephen could do himself, but he really just does not have the hand dexterity. We had been looking through a copy of Paraplegic News, which is a magazine that I actually write for. And there was an advertisement about this whole new intermittent catheter system, which instead of having a separate catheter and a separate urinal, was a totally self-contained package. And we got a couple of samples. But again, there was nobody to ask. Finally, you know, we got it to work. It probably would have worked sooner if we hadn't been so nervous or we had somebody looking over our shoulder.
This is horrifying, though. I mean, it's great you could do it at home. You don't need to go to the hospital for it. You'd have to go 4 times a day. I mean, this wouldn't work. But to have to do it by trial and error on your own is just horrifying.
But that's how most family caregivers learn. We learn on the job. Family caregivers are thrown into the healthcare system and asked to be a part of it, but are not given the respect, are not given the education and training. So we're thrown out there, and it certainly doesn't make any sense. I mean, you're not going to have somebody who you pick up off the street do brain surgery, but you pick us up off the street and have us do some elements of healthcare work without any support or education, without any understanding of what we bring to the situation in terms of both of our assets and our problems.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Suzanne Mintz. She's the co-founder and president of the National Family Caregivers Association and author of the book, A Family Caregiver Speaks Up, It Doesn't Have to Be This Hard. In the best of all possible worlds, what kind of help do you think you should have with your husband's chronic condition?
I think that it is really important to have Stephen's doctors communicate with each other, to monitor medications, to understand how a symptom from, you know, his urinary tract has an impact on, you know, his mobility, or just putting all the pieces together so that there is one health professional. And it doesn't have to be the doctor. It could be somebody in the doctor's office, a PA or an RN who's doing the coordination. But somebody needs to have a complete record of Stephen's medical life. And there also needs to be an understanding of my abilities or lack of abilities to assist him. There needs to be a complete picture of our situation. But I don't think all the help that caregiving family needs is something that can be provided or should be provided by the healthcare system. I think we need to return to the image of barn building, where neighbors and family come together to help each other. We're all going to be in caregiving situations at some point in our lives, whether as the caregiver or as the care receiver. And so there are many things that communities can do to be supportive of each other.
Like what?
There are a number of mechanisms now that people are using. There's a great program called Lots of Helping Hands. It's a web-based program which is an expanded calendar, if you will, by which friends and family can sign up to do specific tasks that a caregiving family needs. One of the most important things is for the caregiving family to be able to say what it is they need. There is the typical situation, people say, call me if you need me. And, you know, the caregiver says, I will, and then never does and can't necessarily define a lot of the things they need help with. But some of the things we need help with are standard items. It's going to the grocery store. It's picking the kids up from soccer practice. It is mowing the lawn in the summer and shoveling the snow in the winter. And these are all part of our normal lives, but caregiving, of course, comes on top of those. So the things we need help with expand exponentially. And people can sign up for as much or as little help as they want to give, but in the process, they form a community of helpers.
There is the option of the home health care agencies, who will provide aids to your home at a fee. It's expensive. It's a pretty expensive way of doing it. But sometimes it's if you can afford it, it's an essential option. However, I think the home health care that you get through these agencies is erratic. You might get somebody who's caring and skilled and wonderful and attentive. And you might get somebody who's not skilled, not caring, and not attentive, and you're not going to know until after you've paid for them a while which category they fall into. If you've gotten somebody who isn't very good, it might take you three more tries to find somebody who is good. It's all very hit and miss, and in the meantime, you're just paying. So I'm wondering what your experiences have been with that kind of paid home health care and how you think we could maybe improve on that front.
Medicare does not pay for ongoing home care. They actually call it custodial care, which I think is extraordinarily pejorative. We are not custodians. And it raises the entire issue of our need for a better home health care workforce. People who are better trained, have a living wage and benefits, who have a career ladder that they can move up. But for the most part right now, that is not the circumstance. And so...
No, I should say they are really low paid when you take away what the agency is getting and you figure out what the home health care worker is actually making. They are really low paid.
Right. And, you know, here they are giving health care and they're not often getting any health care benefits themselves. And so you really have to love doing this work. And there are some people who are amazing. And as you said, there you can go through several times until you find somebody who's really working. And so there are the issues of expense. You know, most people can't necessarily afford ongoing care, even if it's just a couple of days a week for 4 hours, you know, 2 days a week or something.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the emotional needs of family caregivers. And you write about this a little in your book, A Family Caregiver Speaks Up. Your husband was diagnosed with MS in 1974. And shortly after his diagnosis, as he started to become symptomatic, you were raped in your home while your husband was away from home. And you were both going through trauma. And you realized eventually that you both handled trauma and grief different from each other, and that this is an area in which you weren't particularly compatible, you weren't fulfilling each other's needs in this area. Would you describe those differences and the problems that they caused in the relationship?
You know, people talk about opposites attracting, and I suppose it is true. Stephen is the type of person who will tend to keep things in. I tend to like to share and, you know, get support in the talking out of it. So we approach things in a different way. But we were both going through grief for ourselves and for each other. And everybody does that differently. You may start out in denial, and I may start out in anger. And there are, you know, multiple feelings that one goes through in a grieving process. And I used to view Stephen as just being totally stubborn, not fighting, but more complacent. And what I realized is that he actually is a very strong and quiet fighter. His refusal to look into a new piece of equipment, or his still trying to climb stairs when it was so obvious how very, very difficult it was for him, that these were all not being stubborn, but rather his way of defying the MS. I learned to understand that once you admit that you really can't do something the way you were doing it anymore, it is a statement that you're going downhill, that you're not going to be going back in the other direction, that it is a nail in the coffin of your independence. And he came to understand how my nudging him to, well, why don't we, you know, get a stair glide, or let's get hand controls, or why don't we look at it this way, wasn't to be a nag, but because I was so concerned about his safety, and it was so painful for me to watch him struggling. And so we came up with a mechanism for dealing with things, and it has served us extremely well. Well, first of all, just the recognition that we both, you know, had rights in the relationship and that we looked at things differently was a light bulb going on. But what we have come up with is, since he's the one with the MS, that he's the initial driver, and we go with his direction, and I leave it alone. I try and be as supportive as I can, and not say anything. But when I reach a point where I am just so overwrought by it, where I really am concerned that he's going to hurt himself, I call time out. And at that point, we begin to look at things from my perspective, that it might be time for a new piece of equipment, or it might be time to get some some help of one type or another. And then we work it out. We do it in a very understanding and supportive way that helps things be activities of mutual concern and love as opposed to a battle.
Suzanne Mintz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Suzanne Mintz is president of the National Family Caregivers Association and author of A Family Caregiver Speaks Up.